Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from The Lancet Psychiatry. It is October 2023 and I'm Sophia Davis, the Senior Editor at Lancet Psychiatry. And this month I am joined by a trio of guests. We have Lucy Stevenson, Astrid Gieselman and Matej Scholten, whose new review of The Reasons for Using Self-Binding Directives in Psychiatric Practice is out in our issue this month. Firstly, Lucy, Astrid, and Matej, welcome to the podcast. Now, because there's three of you, I thought we'll start with introductions so that our listeners know who is who when you're speaking. So do you want to briefly say who you all are?
I'm Lucy Stevenson. I'm a consultant psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital in South East London in the UK and clinical research associate with the Mental Health Ethics and Law Group at King's College London.
My name is Astrid Gieselman. I work as a researcher and doctor in psychiatry at the Charité in Berlin. And the main focus of my research is on ethical questions in psychiatry.
My name is Matej Scholten. I work as a researcher and lecturer at the Ruhr University of Bochum in Germany. And I have a background in philosophy and I'm originally from the Netherlands.
Wonderful. So I thought we could talk about the paper that you just published with us. Thank you very much for that, which I found really thought-provoking. And that's why I wanted to focus on it. So your review focuses on a particular form of advanced decision-making, known as self-binding directives. Could you give us, first of all, some context into why this type of decision-making is important in mental health settings?
Yeah, thank you. So the concept of self-binding has some great classical roots in the myth of Ulysses. And Ulysses was an ancient mythical adventurer prone to going on long sea voyages. And he commanded the ship's crew to bind him to his ship's mast so he could experience the song of these mythical creatures called the sirens, which was renowned for its beauty. But also what tended to happen to sailors who heard the song of the sirens was that they were lured to jump off the ship and to their death. And so Ulysses wanted to self-bind, literally, to his ship's mast so he could experience this and live. And so I suppose the analogy that often gets drawn is that Ulysses is somebody who's like somebody who experiences episodes of extreme altered mental state, for example, psychosis or mania. And the crew could be understood as analogous to people trying to help that person make it through these episodes. So that could be loved ones, healthcare professionals. And the binding process could be understood as compulsory treatment. And importantly, in the myth, Ulysses anticipated that at the time he really needed to be bound most tightly to the mast, he knew that he was likely to ask his crew to untie him. And he said to his crew, even if I say this, I want you to actually bind me tighter. And in the same way, with a self-binding directive, the person can anticipate that the time treatment is most required when they're most unwell, they're likely to refuse it. And so just sort of thinking about, a more modern day sort of classic example and taking a case that's a bit of an amalgamation of people that we've worked with implementing these kinds of documents. You might imagine someone who I'll call Sam. And Sam's somebody in their 40s. They've been living with bipolar for several decades. He has a part-time job. He's in a relationship. He has kids. And he's had multiple previous episodes of mania, which have required admission and detention under the Mental Health Act, which is the framework governing compulsory admission in England and Wales. And Sam knows when he becomes unwell, his symptoms can escalate really quickly. He can behave very uncharacteristically, say hurtful things to friends and family, damage his property, get into embarrassing situations and risky situations. And his lived experience tells him that once symptoms start, they escalate very quickly. And the only thing that can tame them is admission to a psychiatric hospital. And he knows that that will mean a shorter admission because he gets treatment started sooner and it'll be less distressing for him. But he also knows, his experience also tells him, that at the time the admission is required, once symptoms start, he's likely to try and convince health professionals and loved ones that he doesn't need it. And so he writes a self-binding directive telling professionals about the kinds of thoughts and behaviours he experiences when he's getting unwell, and requests that they consider early admission in the episode, and lets them know that he has this, you know, that what's a repeated pattern is that he's likely to refuse the admission when it's required. And so that's something very helpful for health professionals to know, and can really sort of give them confidence in very difficult decisions about using coercion.
That's fascinating to hear the whole Ulysses mythology. I didn't know that. It's really interesting to explore that analogy as well. And yeah, thank you for explaining that. It's really helpful to put it into perspective of a real life situation, how that might progress and how the whole situation might evolve. So the three of you bring the perspective of different countries' mental health care systems to this piece. And you mentioned in the paper how law and policymakers should consider self-binding directives. It would be great to hear some of the ways that countries do differ on their legislative approaches to self-binding directives. Could you give us some indications of that?
Yeah, so maybe I can tell you something about the situation in the Netherlands and in Germany. And of three countries, the Netherlands is the only country with legal provisions for self-binding directives. So they have explicit provisions saying under which conditions a self-binding directive is valid and when it can be applied. Maybe I can start with the German situation, because I think you understand the challenges of the legislative framework a little bit better if you start there. So in Germany, there are legal provisions for advanced directives in healthcare. And originally, they originated in the context of end-of-life decisions. So if, for example, now I think later I might have dementia, or I have a diagnosis of early dementia, I can make decisions for a later point of time where I can, for example, refuse life-prolonging treatment. And the interesting thing is that these are included in the German law, and it's irrelevant what kind of health condition you have for them to be valid. So they're valid for somatic health conditions, but also for mental health conditions. So we have provisions for psychiatric advanced directives or advanced directives in mental health care. And another thing which brings us a little bit closer to self-binding directive is that in those directives, you can either refuse certain kinds of treatments, but you can also consent to treatments in advance. And normally it would work like that for consent to work, then later on the clinicians also have to think that that treatment is clinically indicated. But what makes it difficult to really complete a self-binding directive in Germany is that you want to ensure that this self-binding directive enables early admission to hospital. So generally, you're not yet exhibiting very radical behaviors, and you're not a danger to yourself or others. You want to have an early intervention. And in the German context, any kind of intervention against your will should have a basis in the law. And that means that the ordinary conditions for involuntary treatment would apply. And one of these conditions is there should be a danger of considerable damage to health. And normally that's not the case yet when you want to intervene earlier. And so this is different, where people can prescribe themselves under what conditions they want to be admitted. So you can complete an advanced directive, and in this advanced directive you write, for example, if I sleep less than 4 hours on two consecutive nights, if I engage in behavior X or Y, and you have a list of conditions, and you think, for me, at that point of time, like Sam, I want to be admitted and I need to be admitted, then that can be done. So usually you complete these directives together with the treating physician or the treating psychiatrist, and also a person of trust. And this person of trust also plays a very important role, of course, because somebody has to observe these behaviors to be present. So normally it's the case that then this person of trust and the treating physician or treating psychiatrist can start and initiate a involuntary admission based on the conditions prescribed by the person themselves.
I see. So that's quite a different situation rather than a blanket rule, having the person actually decide based on their own experience of what they know to be the precursor to a danger to themselves.
Yeah.
Being the determining factor.
Exactly.
So shall I sketch out how it works in England and Wales at the moment? So we have, in contrast to Germany and the Netherlands, we have two pieces of relevant legislation that come into play when we're thinking about this. We have the Mental Capacity Act and the Mental Health Act. And the Mental Capacity Act, which covers decisions about physical and mental health care, has provision for people to make requests, which are non-binding advanced statements about physical or mental health care and treatment, and potentially binding refusals called advanced decisions to refuse treatment. But at the moment, in England and Wales, neither of these provisions contained in the Mental Capacity Act carries any legal weight if the person is detained under the Mental Health Act and making decisions about their mental health. And this has been highlighted as an area where there is significant inequality between physical and mental health law. And there's currently a reform process happening in England and Wales. And the Mental Health Act is potentially going to be reformed to introduce something called advanced choice documents. And these are documents which would allow people to state their wishes for treatment and care, even if they were detained under the Mental Health Act and receiving compulsory treatment. But I should say the final shape and the legal weight of these, the place and the wording and the statute is all to be determined. So it's really a case of watching this space in England and Wales to see how things develop.
Okay, I see. So as well as this difference in countries' perspectives that you all have, I thought it was really interesting that you bring the different disciplinary perspectives to the topic. So you all span between you psychiatry and philosophy. Some listeners will know that my background is in history and philosophy of science, and I love work that bridges different perspectives. So yeah, I wondered if you could talk to how you came together with these different perspectives and to decide on this particular piece of research and what you were really aiming for with it.
Well, when we started this project, Yossi was engaged in the Mental Health and Justice Project, which was a 5-year multidisciplinary research initiative funded by the Wellcome Trust. And this project looked into the interface where mental health care interacts with principles of human rights. And within this project, there was a work stream that focused on advanced directives, and they also worked in partnership with the charity Bipolar UK to conduct a large survey to ask the view of people with a diagnosis of bipolar about self-harm directives. And at the same time, Matthias and I were working together at the Department of Medical Ethics in Bochum. We were engaged in various kinds of projects, but we were mostly part of the SALUS project, which is an interdisciplinary project on ethical aspects within psychiatry, with a focus on questions surrounding coercion. And it was during our involvement in this project that the topic of self-binding directives emerged, which brought us then into contact with Lucy and her colleagues. And one of the reasons why it made sense for us to work together with our different backgrounds, I think, is that in interdisciplinary work, we sometimes have questions which are impossible to reduced to any one discipline. So lawyers can't untangle the puzzle on their own, nor can philosophers or psychiatrists. And the use of self-binding directives is precisely one of these complex issues. It touches on specific clinical situations, but it also raises ethical and legal questions, and the legal considerations can differ dramatically depending on each country's legislative framework. So given this, it simply made sense for us to collaborate on this project together and contribute to this field of research. Now, in terms of our objectives, our primary goal was to gain a deeper understanding of the potential benefits and the associated risks that self-binding directives introduce for service users. To achieve this, we decided to work on a systematic review of reasons, which is a relatively new method in bioethics. And the idea of these systematic reviews of reasons is to structure the conceptual literature on unethical questions and to provide a foundation for further empirical research, and therefore the systematic review of reasons seemed well suited for what we were aiming for.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Maybe I can add, because the debate on self-binding directives has long been kind of a debate within philosophy, and ethicists and medical ethicists voiced a lot of opinions on that. And it was a huge debate starting already like from the late 70s and 80s and 90s. But what was remarkable in our perspective was that stakeholders, so service users and their relatives and professionals, were not really involved in these debates. And so we have connections with service users in both projects, so Salus projects and the Welcome project. And in talking with service users, they saw it as a real possibility, like as a life possibility. This might be interesting for me, where philosophers have thought this is something we do from the armchair, and service users showed real interest in it. And then we thought, let's do also research with stakeholders. So the systematic review of reasons is one part of the research we did, but we interviewed and we did a lot of focus groups with stakeholders. And there we got a real genuine basis for starting to work with this instrument.
That's really great to hear how much you took on the lived experience perspective in the project. You mentioned the wealth of studies in philosophy from before. I did notice that in your review that you're including studies from a philosophical, legal, ethical, psychological, anthropological, and psychiatric approach. So it really, you really took in all these different disciplines.
And that was quite a challenge, be honest.
But it's also interesting to hear that how this project grew out of an initial focus on coercion. So if we get to the meat of the paper and what you found, and you're exploring the ethical issues surrounding self-binding directives for people with severe mental illness, looking at the reasons for and against their use. And I noticed that you found that service user autonomy and related with that differing ideas about coercion, this autonomy featured on both sides of before and against. So I wondered if you could talk more to that particular aspect.
You know, there was a remarkable finding that as a reason for completing a self-binding directive, people say, well, it promotes my autonomy, or it would promote the autonomy of service users. And as a reason against, it also featured that it might limit the autonomy of service users. So, of course, our question was, how can it be? How can it be both a reason for and a reason against? And I think the explanation is, if, for example, if you ask seven philosophers what autonomy is, you get seven different answers. And I think that's kind of the key to the explanation. So maybe we can distinguish between two concepts of autonomy. One, which I would call autonomy proper, that's usually considered being able to act according to your own commitments. So you have certain plans in life. For example, you want to finish university education and you want to commit to that. And just insofar as I act according to that commitment, I am living an autonomous life. That's one conception of autonomy. But there's also another one, which philosophers tend to call negative liberty. And having negative liberty is having the ability to do what you want to do at a given point of time. So it's very important, of course, in liberal society, we want to grant people the opportunity to do what they want, unless they harm others, of course. But if you then look into self-binding directives, what you're doing, for example, imagine Sam, where Lucy told us about. So imagine follow kind of university education, and now a crisis is upcoming. And then if Sam is going to be admitted to hospital based on her instructions, and she's going to refuse hospital admission at that point of time, then of course her negative liberty is going to be restricted. She's not having the opportunity to do what she wants at that point of time, because she wants to stay whole, or she wants to stay out. She doesn't want to go to hospital. But on the other hand, this early admission kind of is compatible with her life plan, because Sam wanted to finish her university education. She made the plan. She made the self-binding directives, and we're acting according to that plan. So I'd say an early admission in the case of Sam promotes her autonomy proper, her ability to live up to her commitments, and it restricts her negative liberty. And so for that reason, we also recommend that people, if they consider completing a self-binding directive, that they think about this question. What kind of liberty or autonomy do I find more important? If I find autonomy proper more important, then it's something for me to complete a self-binding directive. But if I care more for having the opportunity to do what I want at any given point of time, then it's not something for me. And so this is something, a question that people should seriously consider.
That's really interesting, the aspect that the role that time plays there, and one, and the sort of access to one sort of self. So that the self that I occupy at one particular time, do I want to say that's the self that I will give priority to, or do I want myself at any given time to be the one who I give priority to? And that's really interesting that you could then give people the choice, you know, which model of autonomy will you prefer?
And I think that philosophers have always worried about these two selves, so the well self and the unwell self, and they've always asked the question, so if there are two selves, how can the one self decide for the other? That wouldn't be valid like this. This document wouldn't be valid because it's written by the one person and it applies to the other person. That's something we don't allow in modern society. But this is something, if you talk to stakeholders, they don't see that problem. They say, I'm the very same person, but it's only that my preferences at that point of time are different. But I'm still the same person, of course. So of course it would apply. So it's really a concern that stakeholders didn't share. So it's really a philosophical problem, basically, but it's not something which is seen by people in real life.
Mm. And that just, again, demonstrates the importance of integrating, truly involving the perspectives of people with lived experience in with research processes.
Exactly.
So beyond this double-sided aspect of autonomy, what were some of the other key findings that you made for these reasons for and against the use of self-binding directives?
Yeah, so in our analysis, we identified six overarching themes that support the self-binding directives and six themes that oppose them. On the pro side, the most prevalent theme was the promotion of service user autonomy. So self-binding directives were seen as empowering individuals to proactively make decisions about their mental health. The second most common reason that emerged in the literature was the topic of promoting well-being and reducing harm. So several authors discussed that self-binding directives should enable early intervention, and this could prevent the escalations of symptoms and risky behaviors. And consequently, self-binding directives were seen as having the potential to contribute to personal well-being and harm reduction. Then improving relationships was the third reason. So what we found in the literature was that self-binding directives are believed to improve relationships between service users, health professionals, and family members. And this improvement likely arises from the process of drafting such directives, which facilitates communication, especially regarding what would be helpful for service users during a crisis. Equally important as a fourth reason was the idea that self-binding directives might justify coercion. So some of the authors argued that self-binding directives could make psychiatric involuntary treatment ethically less problematic because the intervention would be guided or even requested by the person themselves. And then additionally, two other broad reasons emerged, and stakeholder support was one, and the other was their potential role in reducing coercion. And on the other hand, we found valid concerns against self-binding directives. The most frequently cited concern centered on the potential paradox of diminishing autonomy despite their intended purpose to enhance it. Because some critics argued that self-binding directives may undermine an individual's autonomy, especially when their current wishes during a crisis contradict the directives they set for themselves. The second most prominent concern was implementation problems, and these problems encompass difficulties in drafting, assessing, and applying self-binding directives. The third argument against self-binding directives focused on the challenges of setting mental capacity during drafting and applying self-binding directives. And finally, we identified three other broad reasons against self-binding directives. One involved philosophical considerations about personal identity, another centered on legislative complexities, and the final concern revolves around the potential harm that self-binding directives might cause in certain situations.
Brilliant. Yes, thank you for that summary.
do you mind if I pick up on something?
Yeah, go ahead.
In that, and I was just sort of point of personal interest. You and Mathé were talking about the service users' decision, you know, between what type of autonomy is most important to them. And we did a lot of qualitative interviews with service users, asking them their opinion about this. And one thing that came out to me on reflection is, and it's something I'd love to explore in more depth. It's not something we got into in this paper or any others, but it's just about the service user's evolving personal model of illness and how it impacts them. So if you, and I think that often that changes throughout the lifespan and can explain why it's often service users, you know, who've had, who in sort of early middle age, who are, you know, who've had several experiences of living through episodes, who were maybe quickest to take up this model of advanced decision making. You know, because I think for some people, they can understand it as Mathé is saying, as themselves, who they are, but in a different state. Other people have an almost parasitic sense of illness, you know, that this is an outside force that can swoop in and take over. Other people actually value states of mania. And so, you know, have a very negative view towards people trying to interfere with them. And I think my personal sort of hypothesis is it's really that personal model of mental illness and how it impacts your life that will influence your attitude. And I think that is important to emphasize, that this is a complex, self-finding is complex, and there will be diverse views in the service user and community about it. It's a very personal decision.
So with model of illness, you mean this difference between, do I view it as the difference between like being in different states, and what value do I give to those different states?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. So if you're somebody who values mania, then you're going to really want to rail against infringement on your negative liberty, and you're going to want to make a judgment in that time about the value of that current experience and not want to interfere too. But if you see mania as something that's so parasitic and something that steals from you, it comes from outside, is not part of your authentic self, then you're probably going to prize, as Mathé was saying, autonomy proper, and you're going to want interventions that guard against that intrusion.
And as much as it can be appealing to try to create one single view of what mania is, it's so valuable to see what it is for each individual and how they relate to it, and then and go from there.
And how they understand themselves in relation to it.
Maybe important to add is also that in the self-binding directive, you can not only say when you want to be admitted to a hospital, but of course you can also state treatment preferences for when you're in hospital. So this is another very important aspect, is that so people have been treated involuntarily repeatedly. And what sometimes happens in clinical life is that every time nobody knows exactly what to do. And we're thinking, what would this person want in this situation? And people don't know, even though it happens repeatedly. So self-binding directives, of course, are an opportunity. So if I experienced a couple of crises and I have experienced involuntary treatment, then when I'm well, I could just discuss with my treating psychiatrist and with a person of trust what I would want the next time. And I think this is a very important way in which self-binding directives can promote autonomy, because now we have a concrete occasion to talk about the preferences of service users. And in ordinary clinical life, this goes under the table relatively quickly because of time problems. And now we just have this document, we sit around it, round table, and we're going to discuss. And I think that can be very helpful.
It sounds quite empowering for the person to be so involved in the decisions. I don't know if empowering is just a different way of talking about autonomy, but I think, you know, given the power dynamic that does exist in a psychiatric relationship between a patient and a treating psychiatrist, it is great when some of that can be redressed in such a way. With this paper behind you and having done this big review, what are you hoping will be the next steps, drawing on these findings and how could some of the concerns that you've identified in your paper be addressed?
Yeah, thank you. I think it's we've spoken very positively about self-binding, but I think it's very important to acknowledge that this is a complex debate and there are challenges as well. And we know, speaking in a more general sense, we know that all the empirical evidence suggests that service users want to make mental health advanced decisions, and at least a significant proportion want to make self-binding directives or self-binding advanced decisions. This, you know, ethically challenging type of advanced decision making. And, you know, as Matthew was saying earlier, the policy interest in this area and the service, the stakeholder interest in this area makes this much more than a fascinating intellectual ethical debate. This is a practical issue that policymakers need to wrestle with as more and more jurisdictions internationally think about implementing mental health advanced decision making. And so we sort of hope to provide a comprehensive foundational overview of the arguments in the area so that policymakers can come to a decision with a balanced view about what's right for their area. And as an international collaboration, you know, the three of us represent come from sort of three different universities, and we came up with some recommendations around process considerations and safeguards that help address some of the ethical concerns around self-binding. And those are things that can occur at a service user level, a health organization level, and also a national systemic level. And for service users, it's things like an active offer of support in making documents, the provision of materials, so things like templates, in having enough information about self-binding and the choices around treatment, involving an independent party in the process to address some of those, the power dynamic issues and worries about undue influence. And then at a more sort of health organization level, there's a real need for infrastructure to ensure document accessibility in a crisis. Because, you know, a crisis can involve lots of different agencies, and all of those agencies need to be able to look at it to make sure that, you know, the service users' wishes are held in mind when people are making key decisions. And then there's a suggestion about appropriate safeguards around authorizing the document and how you make a decision about the person's mental state and their capacity to make decisions in that moment. And we've recommended that ideally decisions about capacity, sometimes known as competence, are guided by the service user's own views on signs when they might have lost the capacity to make decisions about the type of treatment and care they want. And then on a sort of a national level, we recommend there should be legal support for implementing these documents so that they're taken seriously and service user wishes are respected. And in London, we've been doing pilot studies of advanced decision-making documents, which offer the opportunity for self-binding. And the self-binding doesn't have any legal weight within our current setup, but we've worked with what we can within our current framework. And that's allowed us to explore some implementation challenges and develop some implementation strategies. And actually, our most recent work has been involvement in a collaboration, which is about ensuring there's a quality of access to using things like advanced decision documents. And we've worked with a team called the ADSTAC team, which stands for Advanced Statements for People from Black African and Caribbean Communities, and tailoring documents so that they're really accessible to people from those communities. And we've also done some work with tech experts to develop digital versions of these kinds of documents to help ease the process of making them and accessing them in crisis. So it's coming quite a long way from the armchair ethical debate into some really practical steps in response to stakeholder demand, really, but with this full knowledge of the complexity of the territory that we're getting into.
Wow, that's really great to have all those different types of guidelines to help people in at different levels be navigating this complex area. So as we start to wrap up our conversation, that do any of you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share on this
topic? Maybe with regard to safeguards, it's I think remarkable that a lot of the safeguards are very basically simple interventions. So you sometimes you think, oh, it's all going to be very complicated. But in the end, the safeguards are pretty simple interventions. For example, one concern that people have regarding self-binding directives is that people will exert undue influence on the decision-making of the service users. So for example, relatives might have an interest in the fact that a person gets admitted to a hospital soon, especially if they, for example, spent money. Psychiatrists might also have certain interest and think it would be good for the person to be admitted early. So if these parties exert undue influence during the drafting process, for example, that would be very problematic. So what we've heard when talking to stakeholders, we got like ideas for how to address that challenge. And I think already including both a person of trust or a family member and a healthcare professional, they hold each other in check already. So the healthcare professional can check whether relatives don't exert undue influence and vice versa. And so apart from that, so we recommend that both parties are involved, but also we recommend that a neutral party facilitates the discussion. And we see a room here for example, peer experts, so people with lived experience who work at a mental health hospital, so they could function as this bridge between the kind of the perspective of the service user and the perspective of the mental health professional. So we think that if we have these two safeguards, we can be pretty sure that this risk of undue influence is at least minimized.
Mm. So lots of different practical solutions that you've been able to bring to this field, it sounds like. So then it just leaves me to thank you all for taking the time out of your day to talk with me through this. It's been fascinating. I've learned a lot from this conversation. And for our listeners, you can read this research from Lucy, Astrid, and Mate online now at thelancet.com. So thanks again to you all for joining me, and thanks to our listeners for tuning into this episode of In Conversation With. And remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With The Lancet Psychiatry wherever you usually get your podcasts.